Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. My name is Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is tax advisor Russell Fox, whose websites are TaxableTalk.com and ClaytonTax.com. Russell Fox, welcome back to Gambling with an Edge.
And it's good to be back.
Since the last time you were on the show, 9 months ago, November 2018, have there been any important laws or legal decision that affects either gamblers or general citizens?
Basically, no new laws on the federal level. There had been discussion in Congress about tax extenders. These are provisions of the tax code that expire every year and get extended every year. But Congress, as they typically do, did nothing. There have been some minor changes on the state level, but that's way too complex to discuss here. There are 50 states. Most have income taxes. A lot of minor changes, but nothing major on the state level. There were two interesting announcements, though. The IRS told the American Institute of CPAs that foreign cryptocurrency exchanges don't need to be reported on the FBAR. But they did this as an announcement, not a ruling. It was just announced at a presentation. There's nothing public about this. There's nothing in writing about it. And that's a big issue. If we go back to when online gambling sites had to be reported on the FBAR, it's a very similar story. The IRS had said back in many years ago, now well over 10 years ago, report them. Then about 2009, they said don't. And then a court ruled in the Hom case a couple years later, yeah, you have to report them. That decision got overturned at appeals, but the IRS made another argument at appeals that would almost certainly have won. They just made it too late. So we're having a very similar situation. There is no penalty for over-reporting accounts on the FBAR. There are lots of penalties for under-reporting.
In the case with the online casinos, when there was this unclearness about whether you had to report or didn't have to report, did they ever go after people in the past who didn't report?
Mr. Hom was gone after, who's the person in the court case. Now, he was gone after because of an audit, and I have obviously no idea what happened in his audit, but this was something he was charged with. So, yes, the IRS, Department of Justice, did go after someone. We don't know how many others because a lot of cases are settled through plea bargains and the like, and you just don't see the results. But the IRS has gone after at least one person on this. They go after a lot of people for non-casino accounts. For example, people who squirrel away millions of dollars in Swiss bank accounts. They're really the primary people being looked for as far as foreign financial accounts. People who take a lot of money, put it aside outside the U.S., continue to make money on that, and don't report it on their U.S. bank accounts, U.S. tax returns. That's the primary people the government wants to go after. Gamblers are just collateral damage in this. But our advice
from— That's our life you're talking about.
Yeah. But wait, so currently they have said you do not have to—
In a verbal announcement, they said you don't have to report—
How is that as a defense if in the future they went after somebody who said and said you had this should have been on the FBAR?
Well, there are some various announcements that are in print. For example, in the Journal of Accountancy, which is an accountant's publication, this was noted. Whether a court would look at this is unclear. Probably for willfulness, the court would look at it, but for non-willfulness, they might not. And there's a difference in the amount of penalty. But our advice right now is just continue to report them, because when in doubt, you report the account, because there's no penalty for over-reporting. Additionally, many people have a requirement in what is called FACTA, Form 8938. If you have much larger foreign account balances, there is no change in the law here. And as far as we can tell, foreign cryptocurrency exchanges need to be reported on Form 8938 for anyone with that filing requirement.
What if it's not on an exchange? What if you're just holding crypto in a wallet?
Those do not have to be reported. That is in writing. FinCEN, which is the agency ultimately that handles the FBAR, has said publicly and put it in writing, cryptocurrency held in a U.S. exchange or in a wallet does not, for example, a hardware wallet, does not have to be reported.
I've always, I'm the furthest thing imaginable from a crypto expert, but I've always thought it really kind of crazy to keep your money in an exchange just because there have been exchanges that have gone down and had their money stolen, whereas if you have your crypto wallet, yeah, I guess you could lose it or whatever, but anyway, just one more reason not to keep your money in an exchange.
Okay, the second announcement happened to be one of the questions you sent me, but I think it's important to emphasize this. And it is the IRS has been sending letters to people we believe they found through the Coinbase summons. About 4 years ago, the IRS issued what is called a John Doe summons to Coinbase, one of the largest U.S.-based cryptocurrency exchanges, saying, send us a list of all your customers. The reason the IRS did this is back, and I don't remember which year, they looked and 802 people reported cryptocurrency transactions on their tax returns. In that particular year, I want to say it was like 2011 or 12, 40 of them were returns I prepared. So I prepared 5% of the tax returns with cryptocurrency in that particular year. Chance of that being really that I did 5% of the people who had cryptocurrency transaction is, of course, zero. What it meant was a lot of people weren't reporting it. Coinbase fought the summons and lost in court. The court ruled that almost every Coinbase account, there were some minor exceptions, had to be reported to the IRS. The IRS has used this and sent out letters to people. There are three versions of this letter. Version 6174-A, we believe, has been sent to people who have actually included cryptocurrency on their tax returns. It does list out the fact you need to include it, but for most of the people who got that, they probably can ignore the letter. There's a letter 6174, which so far none of my clients have received. I've seen the letter online. It matches in text the 6174A letter. We think, but we don't know, that this is being sent to people who haven't filed returns for the particular year in question.
Filed returns or filed cryptocurrency?
Filed a tax return. So they may not.
At all.
Yes. Remember, not everyone has a filing requirement. If you, for example, did 10,000 cryptocurrency trades and made $3, and that's your only income, you don't have a filing requirement. So there's nothing particularly, you know, just because you have a lot of cryptocurrency transactions doesn't mean that you necessarily have a filing requirement. It's a guess on our part. We don't know.
So most of your clients have more than $3 in income.
We would hope so. And then there's a letter 6173. This is a very serious letter because these are been sent to people who have filed returns but didn't include cryptocurrency transactions on them, and the IRS believes that they had cryptocurrency trades. Now, one, it's possible the IRS is wrong. The IRS makes lots of mistakes. A client of mine today got a letter alleging he, through an amended return, owed $200,000 in tax when he didn't owe anything. So IRS does make mistakes, but if they're really using the Coinbase data, a lot of people probably need to file amended returns. People who get letter 6173 should speak to a tax professional. If the amounts involved are egregious, in the millions of dollars of income, they probably need to speak to a tax attorney, and they should probably do this soon rather than hold off. This is something could be, you know, if it's large, the IRS is certainly going to make an example of someone out there and refer somebody for a criminal prosecution because they want people reporting this.
Does there appear to be a, we'll call it come to Jesus window, where if you are report now that you were negligent in the past, but now you're report it and pay all due taxes, that all is forgiven?
Well, you're going to owe some penalties and interest. There's a late payment penalty. You file late. If you underreport by 20%, you could be hit with a penalty. Interest is statutory. You're always going to owe that. But
these are rather minor penalties.
Yes, they're generally minor, but still they exist. You said penalties. All is forgiven. No, not all is forgiven. But usually when you go to the IRS, things are handled quite differently than the IRS coming after you. So again, I'm a licensed tax professional. Only advice I'm ever allowed to give is compliance with the law. Law is very clear in that cryptocurrency transactions do need to be reported. The IRS is basically giving a window. There's nothing specific about time, but they're giving a window here. People who haven't reported probably should take advantage of it.
So that's the only advice you're allowed to give? You're not allowed to say betting on the Browns to win the Super Bowl is a bad idea? You can't give that advice?
I can give betting on the Lions is a bad idea.
All right. Let's go on. We asked our listeners for questions. Here are some of the better ones. I have a regular job that pays well, and I'm also an advantage player. Last year, I filed the Schedule C as a professional gambler. Is this allowed? Some people seem to think not. I played for the purpose of profit and played with continuity and regularity. I played several days per week, every week. I regularly put in many hours of study and practice, and I generated a profit. The Supreme Court ruled in the Grotzinger that it has to be done full-time. There are many people who file a Schedule C for various part-time side businesses. Why would professional gambling be treated any differently?
Well, the tax code in many respects does treat professional gamblers differently. And as to why, ask Congress.
Oh,
I can't answer that question. However, the IRS has tried to hold that a professional gambler must have that occupation as an exclusive profession. Courts, though, have ruled quite differently. For example, in Lee versus Commissioner, the tax court ruled, respondent argues that petitioner did not pursue his gambling activity full-time. In effect, respondent is arguing that gambling must be the only or predominant source of income. We could find no statute or case precedent that sets forth such requirement. So the correct answer to the listener's question is, it depends. To be a professional gambler, you must gamble on a regular basis for your livelihood. It doesn't have to be full-time, but it has to be regular. And for your livelihood means as part of what you're using to pay your bills. It does not have to be your only job, but it can't be a hobby. The more you treat it like a business, the better if you want to be a professional. So what this means is you should consider having a separate bank account for your gambling business. You might want to write a business plan. I know it seems rather stupid to write a business plan for gambling, but courts look at that. There are, on the IRS website, which is irs.gov, and it's actually an excellent website. If you do a search in the search box in the top right for hobby rules, you will find a web page listing out the 9 factors that are used to determine whether something is a hobby or a business.
All right, and that would apply to gambling as well as other things?
Yes.
Okay. Moving on. Does having a large number of W-2G winnings in a given year increase the likelihood of being audited if you're not filing as a professional gambler? If so, would players' card activity and or personal logs, possibly showing non-W-2G winnings, likely be reviewed?
Well, it's really a two-part question. First part is, does having a large number of W-2G winnings make you more likely to be audited? The answer is no. That from experience, I've been doing this 19 years, and so at least from what I've seen, no. However, dollars makes you more likely to be audited. The simple fact is, if I make $1 million and Bob makes $100,000.
Can you turn that around? I really sounds
okay.
Better.
Okay, if Bob makes $1 million and I make $100,000.
It's not true, but it sounds better.
And we both cheat on our taxes by 10%.
Oh. Never mind.
Where does the IRS get more bang for the buck in conducting an audit? Well, in this case, Bob. Okay? And the IRS isn't completely stupid. They're going to audit people who make more money. So because your W-2Gs could lead to increased income, the increase in income may let you have a higher chance of being audited. Also may lead more to at least a higher chance of being audited on your gambling losses. Because let's say you have 300,000 of W-2Gs and you have 300,000 of losses. Well, you're going to offset those in two different places on your tax return when you're an amateur. And the 300,000 of gambling losses is going to have a higher chance of being audited. I have seen audits on gambling losses. So that indirectly, the dollars could lead to a higher risk of audit.
It just magically happens that your losses exactly equal your winnings. That would sound like a red flag to me.
Well,
but if you think about 99.9% of all recreational gamblers, their losses exceed their winnings.
That part is true.
So,
and you can only put down the total maximum gambling losses you can put down is the amount of your winnings.
So it isn't such a red flag.
No, but just the large dollar amount is. But the second part of the question, which relates to would players' club activity and personal logs be reviewed? Absolutely. But one of the things is, let's say your name is an unusual name, John Krasinski. There aren't very many of John Krasinskis out there. One of the things the IRS is now required to do in an audit is do a Google search on you. If your name is John Smith and they do a Google search, you're not going to find much because there are lots of John Smiths out there. If your name is John Krasinski, there aren't as many. And they might see John Krasinski cashes for $3,000 in a poker tournament. Well, that $3,000 had better be on your tax return, W-2G or not.
Wait, so they... These are people that they're going to audit, or this? How do they decide who to Google search?
Anyone who is being audited. It's not, as far as we know, used for audits, although, mind you, there are rare exceptions. For example, people who brag on the internet that I embezzled $10 million. That person might get looked at, but if you're being audited.
Pretty stupid person.
Yes, but there are a lot of stupid people out there. If you're being audited, the IRS is required to do a social media search. That requirement's been out there. And you know, they'll just type in your name. Your name is John Smith. It's pretty much, they're not going to find anything because there are lots of John Smiths out there. Your name is unusual. Unfortunately, you have a better chance of the IRS finding this out. In any case, on your tax return, you have to list out all income, whether you receive a W-2G or not.
Another reason why many blackjack players go through legal name changes, another reason to pick a very, very common name. Because it's also true of the casino's database, right? If Caesars Entertainment is going to look in their database of, you know, players named John Smith, they're going to find an awful lot of them.
Yeah, I recommend Pat Lee. It doesn't know whether you're Asian or black or white or male or female. So that's a good one. Now, part of that question was players club data. Now, I know from history that the information I get from slot clubs at the end of the year is not highly correlated with what my records say. I assume the IRS is aware of this, and I assume the IRS is aware of, I can cherry pick which ones I show, and if I'm behind at some and ahead at others, only show the ones that meet whatever my goals are. So the players' club activities, I assume, wouldn't be worth that much.
Well, in Las Vegas, that's definitely the case. The auditors in Las Vegas are well aware of the faults of players' club data. If you happen to live in Ottumwa, Iowa, or Kalamazoo, Michigan, or someplace where gambling is not a big activity.
There's more gambling in Kalamazoo than you think.
There might be, but where the auditor is not as trained in gambling and doesn't do as many audits where it's an issue, it's going to be a problem because the IRS is an agency out of the 1950s. They love paper. Paper records are wonderful, and they will think that the Players Club card is gold. I've gone through this in audits and have to explain to them the data on there can be wrong. And luckily, the regulation that exists on gambling says that if you keep a contemporaneous log and note everything on it, that is to be accepted. So we strongly recommend all of our clients keep a contemporaneous written log. You can use a phone app, just back it up every month so you have a record of it, so the IRS doesn't think it was created right before the audit. But keep your own log. It will be taken seriously. Courts especially like logs.
All right. Somebody wants to know, can the entry fee for a high-dollar, privately run football pool be included in gambling losses to offset gambling wins? The organizers of this pool don't report any winnings to the IRS. What kind of documentation would be needed? Is there a risk of creating issues with IRS for organizers or pool winners?
Okay, before we get to the answer to this question, I'm going to ask Richard and John, excuse me, Richard and Bob, you can hit me in the head later, a question. This is a real question that I was asked when I took the exam to become an enrolled agent.
Uh-oh, I think a trick question's coming here.
It's not a trick question.
Uh-huh.
John won $10 in a home poker game. How much of the income must he include on his tax return as other income? John is not a professional gambler, and he has $10 of other gambling losses. It's a multiple choice. A, $10. B, none, because his $10 of winnings are offset by his $10 of losses. C, none, as he is eligible for the de minimis exception to reporting gambling winnings. You got a 1 in 3 chance.
Well, now it's funny because when I was thinking before you read the answers,
you thought it had
I was
to be
thinking
a, but yeah.
that you have to declare it. But then I thought, well, wait, maybe there's some minimum, right? Like on interest and things, there are minimums where you don't have to declare them if the interest from some bank was under, I think the number's $10 or something or whatever it is. So now I'm thinking it might be C.
I'll take a guess.
And I'm thinking A.
Okay, I'll pick C, he'll pick A.
Answer is A. There's no de minimis exception to reporting income. The exception you noted about interest is the bank doesn't have to send you a 1099. You still have to report it.
Ah, okay.
Okay. So that gets to the answer to this question, which is the tax code at heart is fairly simple. All income is taxable unless Congress exempts it. Nothing is deductible unless Congress allows it. Congress has not exempted private football pools from taxation. Thus, any winnings from those pools has to be included on your tax return. And any losses would be a gambling loss that you can take to the extent of your gambling winnings, as long as you've got proof you entered the pool, receipt, copy of a check, bank statement, email, wire transfer. So the gentleman's
contemporaneous record.
Yes, but any of those, you know, gentleman said it's a large dollar amount pool, so probably there's some sort of proof. Also, this activity should be included in your gambling log for the year. Now, the other part of the question, I have to preface this, I'm not an attorney, I can't give legal advice. I do think the organizers of the pool may want to consult an attorney in their jurisdiction, as most states have laws about facilitating gambling activity. And if the prizes are significant, which it sounds like, the organizers may be in violation of the law. I have a friend who used to organize a pool, he's an attorney, and he realized he was in violation of his state's law, and he quit organizing the pool and even participating in the pool. Somebody else now organizes it because he just doesn't want to risk his license.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is when you list on your tax form your losses versus your gains, there's no section for, well, this much was from poker, this much was from a pool, this much was from a slot machine. You know what I mean? It's just a lot. Now, yes, if they come and they look at your records, they could say, oh, this was in a football pool or whatever. But
yeah, the IRS is interested in you reporting your income accurately, exactly what you make, no more, no less. And you're allowed your gambling losses. You just have to have proof of them. And you only need to prove it if you're audited. And you're exactly right, Richard. You just report your gambling losses as one number.
So those people who play video poker for quarters, where the highest jackpot is normally $1,000, because they want no tax liability, and in their mind it has to be $1,200 or more before they get tax liability, they are incorrect and very possibly will get away with it. Is that true?
They're definitely incorrect. I'd prefer not to comment about the latter, but I think most people can add two and two.
Okay. One more question before we get to our favorite part of the show, which is the commercials.
Oh, wait a minute. I have a question. I just thought of this one now. There was this idiot in California, in the California legislature, that wanted to pass a law disallowing gambling losses from wins because he said it only helped wealthy gamblers. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, I don't think it got anywhere in the California legislature, as I know. But there are a bunch of states with that rule.
I know there are.
And there was some – the horse lobby in California, horse racing lobby, is extremely powerful, which to me is interesting given the state of horse racing. And I think they put the kibosh to that.
That's good. It just – the reasoning behind it was just kind of the craziest thing I had ever heard.
There is an old Mark Twain quote. I think it's Mark Twain. Suppose I met a congressman. Suppose I met an idiot. But I repeat myself.
Yeah.
That does sound somewhat like Mark Twain. Since Richard mentioned California, we have a question here about California. President Trump has famously refused to produce his tax returns for public consumption. The state of California, and perhaps other states in the future, has passed a law saying that candidates who do not produce tax returns cannot be on their primary ballot. What does your crystal ball say about how this will play out?
Again, prefacing this, I'm not a constitutional scholar in any way. My expectation is that California has every right to do this for candidates for California statewide office. They can put whatever they want for California statewide office. They have absolutely no right to do this for federal office, especially when the conditions to be president are specified in the Constitution of the United States. I suspect that there will soon be an injunction, temporary restraining order, permanent injunction, etc., about enforcement of this law. So far, I think there are 6, maybe 7 lawsuits to stop this. Not only has President Trump filed a lawsuit with the Republican Party and a lot of others, because we're up to 6 or 7 at last count. And it's just one of these things where the Constitution of the U.S. says qualifications to be president, I think, are you have to be 35 years old,
yes,
a U.S. citizen, and have resided in the United States for 14 years. I think you have to be a natural-born citizen, too. Okay. That's it. And so with California trying to impose more qualifications, that's probably a violation of the Federal Supremacy Clause.
Okay, good. And now, as we promised, our favorite part of the show, these are our commercials. We'll be getting back to Russell Fox in a few minutes. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In August, the prizes are logo merchandise advertising the South Point or the South Point 400 NASCAR race. Each week, Monday through Thursday, earn 1,300 points on any machine and get the prize. Since this is going to be aired on August 29th, you probably already know this or are not going to take advantage of it. But if you have earned and collected all 4 prizes, then come in on Saturday, August 31st, for $100 in free play. Just a few days after this first airs, on September 3rd, Tuesday, starting at noon, the next 10-week semester of free video poker classes will begin. There are flyers available at the club booth with a class schedule, which will also may be found at bobdancer.com/seminars. The first class is Jacks Are Better, which is the basis for most non-wildcard games. Later in the semester, we'll be getting into some Deuces Wild variations. But Jacks Are Better is a basis for double bonus and double-double bonus and super double bonus and all the other ones that we teach. So if you're not really familiar with that game, it's a good place to start your learning process. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Peek and Play Poker. This is 7 coins per line game where you get to see the first card off the pack of 47 remaining cards after the first 5 are dealt. You must take that card, assuming you don't hold all 5 original ones. Let's say you're dealt ace, king, queen, jack of spades, and a red 4. In normal video poker, you hold all 4 spades, say a prayer, and hope for a royal. Here, if you know that another ace is coming, you just hold the ace. And you hope for 4 aces. Knowing that next card changes the hold in a lot of common sense ways. All right, we're back to our guest, Russell Fox, with tax news. It's another question from a listener. If your W-2Gs have been lost and the casino isn't helpful at sending a copy, how should I list them on my taxes? The example provided by our listener was an $18,000 jackpot, losing the W-2G, and the casino says, take a hike.
Well, first thing is you should try to get a transcript from the IRS that will show your W-2Gs, and this is free and available to basically anyone. If you go to the IRS website, irs.gov, type get transcript in the search box in the top right, and you'll go to a page where you can order a transcript. You want to order a wage and income transcript for the year in question. There are 2 ways of ordering this. You can order a mailed copy and it shows up in about 2 weeks, or you can attempt to download it. About half the people who try the online version of getting this form will be successful. Unfortunately, half will not be.
Didn't earlier you say they had a great website?
They do, but there are limitations. Here, the IRS is very careful about records because this is your tax information, and the IRS is very careful. And here, having a common name doesn't help because the IRS when you sign up for an account, they ask questions about you and your name. And if your name is John Smith, it can get confusing. When this first came out, my business partner and I tried it. I was successful. He was not.
Okay, and so this is intentional on their part. It's not just a broken website.
No, it's
website.
Not broken. Okay. It's more they are very, very careful about data online. And frankly, I think it's a good idea. But you can always ask for one to be mailed to you, be mailed to the address on your last tax return unless you've updated your address with the IRS. An issue people should do, you actually want to send change of address forms to the IRS and your state tax agency. You may not want to get letters from them, but it's a good idea for them to have your current address.
I would also add that just like the losses, your win is a lump sum number, and if you do any gambling at all, your total wins should be more than your W-2Gs because you would have had winning sessions and losing sessions.
And that's the next point, which is, let's say this W-2G doesn't show up on the transcript. The transcripts themselves are not guaranteed to be accurate until the February following the year. So, for example,
February 1st, February 28th?
For calendar year 2018.
Yes.
They're not accurate till February 1st, 2020.
2020.
Oh, wow. 2020.
Ah, so that's in your.
They're not guaranteed to be accurate.
Uh-huh.
Okay, IRS is not known for its efficiency. So it's quite possible it won't show up because maybe the casino in question hasn't sent it yet to the IRS, even though they're supposed to be sent. The IRS hasn't processed it. There are a lot of reasons, or just error, which happens. just include that $18,000 as additional gambling winnings and you're fine. The IRS really doesn't distinguish that much between what's on a W-2G and what isn't. And if it does come up that you didn't include it, you just explain, hey, I didn't have the W-2G, it was lost. I included it as additional gambling winnings. And it all should be fine.
Now, when you see this list, two cases. One, a casino has assigned you a W-2G you did not get. They put $50,000 in my name at a casino I've never been to in my life. How should I deal with that?
Well, if you got the $50,000, it would be a different thing. But if you don't get it, you should probably call the casino in question and talk to their accounting department and state what happened. You have on my IRS wage and income transcript that you supposedly issued a W-2G to me. The current wage and income transcripts will even show the date. So let's say it showed August 10th, 2018. You can tell them, and they can look to see what kind of error. It might be that, for example, the casino you have never been to, but your Players Club card is a typo away from being somebody else because it's a shared Players Club card with other casinos you have been to. So the person doing the data entry somehow made a typo, and instead of it being issued to John Smith, it was issued to Bob Dancer. The casino, if you can prove to them that it wasn't yours, will issue a corrected W-2G with a $0 amount. Takes a while to be processed, but eventually, again, by February, it will be processed.
All right.
The second case, of course, they don't. Let's assume they basically treat you and say, we don't care, and hang up the phone on you.
Yes.
You're left with two options. First, if your total gambling winnings, if you add up all your W-2Gs, let's say it's $200,000.
Uh-huh.
But your total gambling winnings, including that incorrect W-2G, your total gambling winnings, let's say, are more than that, just report the W-2G even though it's wrong in your total because you'd be reporting it anyway. And you just subtract the additional gambling winnings. So let's say your total gambling winnings are $210,000. You really have $150,000 of W-2Gs and $60,000 of non-W-2G winnings. But you have this phony W-2G of $50,000 listed in your winnings. The practical solution is to use the W-2G total and lower your other gambling winnings. If, however, it's too much, let's say the total W-2Gs are $200,000, but your total gambling winnings are $180,000, you're left with two choices. One, increase your gambling losses appropriately. If it doesn't change your taxes, that's one way of dealing with it. If you're a professional gambler, include that as a return and allowance. It's not your income. Okay, and especially if you can prove you were nowhere near that casino on that specific day, it'll hold up an audit. I've had this exact issue in an audit where there was a wrong W-2G on a client's transcript, and we could show the taxpayer was nowhere near the state in question on that date. You have to then, you could subtract it out. The IRS's procedure for an incorrect information return is that you subtract it out and put a note. We don't like that method because it usually leads to either an IRS notice or an audit, which we try to avoid. One other comment I'll make. When we get this issue, we strongly advise you send a certified letter to the casino if they don't do any change. You want to put it in writing that you tried to get the casino to change it. You want to send it via certified mail so you have proof.
Proof that you sent something.
Proof you sent something. Keep a copy of the letter. On the letter, include the certified number. So that 12-digit certified number, I think it's 12 digits these days, you put it in the body of the letter.
Uh-huh. There are, following up on this a bit, I find Richard's player's card in the casino, And since in this hypothetical world, we're not best friends, and I'm quite willing to throw him under the bus, I'm using his card, hit a jackpot, and when the attendant comes up, I say, my records are on file. And in this particular case, he does play at this casino periodically. He has hit W2Gs, and so they have it. But he wasn't there that day, but he was in the city. But not, I mean, nowhere near means, well, this was at the Rio, and he was at the Gold Coast. I mean, that's, you know, next door. So he can't prove he was nowhere near, and he gets his extra W2G. Because the casino doesn't check for ID, they're supposed to, but a lot of casinos say, yeah, or if you're on file, we'll just use the record that's on file.
Well, same issue. You basically do the same thing. If you can get away with just including it and it isn't going to change your toll, the simplest way is just include it. Second thing, hire a hitman. No, that's not a good idea.
Good.
Not a good idea. You make an adjustment on your return for it if you're a professional gambler and you get an incorrect W2G. That's all the easiest way of dealing
with
it.
Not only am I screwing him financially, I'm going to kill him now. This show might not be on the air much longer, folks. Okay.
Oh, I think he meant I killed you, not
you.
Oh,
that's
me.
What it was. Well, this show might not be on the air much longer, folks.
But seriously, if you get a mistake, write the first, call the casino and get them to change it. Most casinos want you as a patron. Okay? You're making money for the casino. When there are mistakes, most casinos will cooperate and get them fixed. That's at least been my experience. If they don't, I mean, it happens. For example, I had a client where the casino went out of business. They were sold, and so the accounting department got canned. There was nobody there to make a change. In that case, we made an adjustment on the return and just put it in as an additional return and allowance. That's for a professional gambler. Situation's a bit more complex when you're an amateur gambler. You may want to try to add it just as an additional gambling loss, although that is technically not correct. It's the easiest way of dealing with it. But you need to speak to your tax professional to see what will work in your specific situation.
All right, moving on. What are the tax implications of gamblers lacking a tax home, being on the road 365 days a year without a long-term residence? My basic understanding is without a tax home, you cannot deduct travel expenses, as technically you aren't ever leaving from anywhere.
You know what? I was fascinated by this question when it came up because I've never heard of this. I thought you had to choose somewhere
Well, the answer is, the questioner is absolutely correct. This is what is called the traveling salesperson issue, and there's a lot of case law on it. If you don't have a tax home, there are no travel expenses because travel is defined as being away from your tax home. No tax home, no travel.
So what?
But.
Yeah, what do you need to pick an address and say that's my home?
It's fairly easy to obtain a tax home. First, let's say during the year you happen to be traveling, but most of the time you really reside in Missoula, Montana. You own a home in Missoula. But this year, you don't like the Montana winter, so you're going to travel the world for a year. Your tax home is still Missoula, because that's where you intend to return to. But let's say you had sold your home in Missoula, you hadn't decided where to go, and you travel the world, you might not have a tax home. So it's a good idea, before you do this traveling the world, you set up a tax home. There are other ways of setting up a tax home. A tax professional can go over them with you. This is a problem that most taxpayers should never have. Just an ounce of prevention, a little talk, set up a place, be there for a few months, and you won't have this issue before you start traveling.
I remember George Bush claimed Texas as his tax home, even though he had never lived there, because he intended to move there after he was out of office, because they had no state income tax.
Well, one of the George Bushes, you're correct. One actually had a ranch there. I'm not sure which George.
Well, he was governor. One of them was governor there. Yeah, so he probably lived there.
Yeah, but the other one owned extensive property there. He hadn't had a home there, but he actually did move to the Houston area when he left office. So most of the time, presidents tend to at least.
Okay. For the last several World Series of Poker final tables, you calculated your best guess of the tax liabilities of the final nine. Did you do that this year? And if so, what were the results?
Yes, I did it this year. My business partner wants me to do it every year, so I did it. And the results were 39% of the money went to taxes, which wow. is...
U.S. or other countries, too?
Both.
Yeah.
It depends. For example, the winner, Hossein Ensan, and if I butcher somebody's name, my apologies, is German. And there was a question whether he's a professional gambler or an amateur. It matters for German taxes. An amateur gambler doesn't owe anything. Professional owes German tax. And he would have lost.
Being a highly trained professional, Bob silences his cell phone right after he told you to silence yours.
I thought I had. Oh, well.
Anyway, Mr. Ensan lost about 46% to taxes if he is a professional. As best as I could tell, it's debatable. And the German tax authorities will probably be looking into this matter. Germany is a high tax area, high tax state.
Well, yeah, the $4 million is worth them to put some investigators on it to see if they can prove he's a professional.
Correct. Dario Sammartino, who finished in second, same issue. The ESPN broadcast said he lives in Florence, Italy. Somebody emailed me saying he lives in Austria. Difference is about, $2.5 million.
Wow.
Okay, Austria, very little to no tax. Italy, $2.5 million of his $6 million. Gone. Certainty, Alex Livingston's tax bill, $1.2 million. He is a Canadian. 30% will be withheld for taxes.
By Canada? The U.S.
By the U.S.
Oh, by the U.S.
By the U.S. He won't owe a penny in Canadian tax. He may be able to get a small amount of that $1.2 million back based on his other U.S. gambling losses. But I had some people saying he gets it all back. That is definitely not the case. Again, only gambling losses up to the amount of winnings. So, and only the U.S.-Canada tax treaty specifies this treatment. So, for example, if he was from Australia, he wouldn't get any of it back.
There's a volume button. You can just silence it completely.
The most interesting individual for taxes was the ninth place finisher, Milos Srbtic. S-K-R-B-T-I-C. So take your
Come
guess
on,
as
Russ,
to pronounce
this
that.
Stuff. Come on.
He lived in Serbia. The U.S. and Serbia don't have a tax treaty, so if he had remained there, 30% would have been withheld by the U.S. And because of the way the Serbian tax laws work, he would have lost 20% to Serbian tax. He would not have been allowed a tax credit, even though he is a professional gambler. However, he moved. Although I do question his choice from a tax standpoint, he moved to California.
Oh, that's a smart move.
Yeah. He loses over 46% to taxes, but it's better than 50. I will grant that it is better than 50%. So of his $1 million, I calculate he'll get $525,000 and change. The biggest tax agency winner this year was the German tax agency, which I won't even try to pronounce their name.
If they can collect.
IRS finished second, Italian third, Illinois Department of Revenue fourth, and the Franchise Tax Board barely fifth place.
Wow.
One other interesting
The U.S.
feature,
government isn't on there?
IRS.
Yeah. Ah, okay.
One other interesting thing, the seventh place finisher ended up in fifth place based on after-tax winnings. Seventh place winner was Nick Marchington, who is from the United Kingdom. United, U.S. and U.K. have a tax treaty specifying no gambling winnings will be withheld. So nothing to the IRS. The U.K. does not tax gambling winnings. So he gets all of his winnings, or $1.5 million. So he finishes ahead of the fifth-place finisher, Kevin Moss, and the sixth-place finisher, Zen Kai.
Very good. For next year's World Series of Poker, let's assume I decided to back a certain player. How do we set this up in writing to protect both of us tax-wise?
You want proof of the agreement. I've been told by attorneys that verbal agreements are binding, but from an IRS standpoint, you want something in writing. Now, mind you, it can be emails, correspondence, an actual agreement in writing. That's between you and your backer and any attorney involved, but in writing. Second, you want to fill out Form 5754. It's an IRS form. You can find it on the IRS website. It's used specifically for backing situations, although the RIO will famously, as you mentioned, ignore it. But you still want the form. Then at year end, you need to send out a 1099 miscellaneous to your backer. You send one 1099 per person, per year, per type of income. So you send one for his net amount won off you. Let's look at an example. Let's say you back me, handing me $5,000 for the $10,000 WSOP main event, and I net a win of $20,000, that's net winnings, and I hand you $10,000. I would send you a 1099 miscellaneous at year end for $10,000.
So you're actually giving him $15,000, right?
Correct. But yeah. The taxable amount is $10,000.
Okay.
You do it based on how much income is made. So let's say the WSOP, somehow I broke dead even. I finish in a tie for whatever the last place is, and I get nothing other than my buy-in back. I'd hand you your share, $5,000. There would be no 1099 issue because there's no income.
Uh-huh.
Okay. You would complete Form W-9. Basically giving me your tax information, name, address, tax ID number, so I could complete the 1099. A couple caveats about this. 1099 miscellaneous forms cannot be downloaded off the internet. They're printed on special paper. You have to order them from the IRS. You also need to order a Form 1096. It's a cover page you use when you send 1099s to the IRS. They're free to order, by the way. You just send away for it. You can order them online. You can call the IRS up and have them send them to you. It takes about 2 weeks to get them. You can order extras. Strongly advise you can send them out. Order some extras because you'll make mistakes. They're printed on, as I said, special paper with like five. It's an NCR form, like five layers of paper. If you are backed by a non-American, there are special rules. And it would be a very lengthy conversation. I've written about it on my website. If you do a search on my website, taxabletalk.com, for WSOP and taxes, you will find it, and you can read through all the gory details.
Okay. Gene Scott and Marissa Chin have produced more than one version of the book, Tax Help for Gamblers. You are now involved in this book. What is your role? And how is the book, after your help, different than it was before your help?
Well, the last edition came out, I want to say 2014, but it could have been 13. It's rough time period. And tax law has changed drastically. We went through major tax reform at the end of 2017. My role was to update the tax information based on changes to the tax law. Also update the state tax information. So that's really what I did, is update the book based on tax law changes, also a few changes based on how the IRS is conducting audits.
So Gene and Marissa are still involved with the book?
Yes.
And you're just making it current. All right. Sounds like you had the heavy lifting in this version.
There was some lifting.
All right. We have a few minutes left. A few months ago, you wrote that sending your tax return by normal mail it's a pretty stupid thing to do. What did you mean by that?
Let's change that to pretty stupid to very stupid. Okay.
You wrote that it is very stupid. What did you mean by that?
Okay. Let's say you put a forever stamp on your tax return. You owe $10,000 to the IRS. You enclose a check payable to the United States Treasury, correctly noting it, and mail it on April 15th. For whatever reason, the post office loses your mail, which happens. 2 months later, you find out that your check hasn't been cashed. You call the IRS up, and they tell you they never received your return. You put a stop payment on the check, print another copy, and mail it on June 20th. On July 10th, you get an IRS notice assessing a late filing penalty of $1,500, a late payment penalty of $150, and interest of $100. Instead, imagine the same exact scenario, except you mailed the original return using certified mail. We recommend you also get a return receipt. The return still gets lost. You still mail the second return. You get the same IRS notice. You respond to the IRS notice with a copy of your receipt for certified mail and unless you really have some issues, that $1,750 penalty will get abated. Good reason to spend $5 on certified mail. I have a specific example of a client of mine who filed a sales tax return where he owed over $100,000, in fact, significantly over $100,000. And he mailed it for, I think, 42 cents. That was the cost of a stamp at that time. And it got lost. And his State Department of Revenue assessed fines and penalties, plus there were legal costs. Fines and penalties were well over $100,000. The whole thing in the end cost him just under $90,000. Versus spending, at the time, $3.79 for certified mail.
Uh-huh.
Okay. One other example, which is more humorous in nature. I've had some payments lost by the IRS, including a few years ago, an IRS driver was transporting payments from the San Francisco lockbox to Hayward, which is across the San Francisco Bay, for those familiar with the Bay Area. And the driver got in a traffic accident on the Hayward Bridge, and his truck went over the bridge. Those payments went with the fishes.
Uh-huh.
Those people who mailed certified mail had absolutely no issue getting the payment credited on the date it was originally mailed. I had a client impacted by this. So it's good insurance.
But it helps the fish in the bay. Finally, last time you're on the show, you suggested using the email address rcfox@claytontax.com. Is that still the best way to get in touch with you?
Yes, it is.
Very good. Russell, thank you for being here. It's always informative and pleasurable. We're glad you laughed. You left us on a laugh. So thank you. Richard, thank you very much. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.